you know, there's no jury. It's just a judge basically deciding whether Donald Trump would be paying a $250 million fine. But then there's also the trial that he sees as more important, which is in the court of public opinion. We definitely saw that yesterday. We're seeing that last week with Trump's sons when they, you know, were saying that they don't recall, that they, you know, in angry times, they also were very much, you know, kind of going on their own little angry kind of rants. And so, yeah, a lot of what we're seeing is just politics in the courtroom.
Well, we're going to do part two and post online at democracynow.org. Lauren Artani, reporter for The Guardian U.S. Happy belated birthday to John Hamilton and Emily Anderson. I'm Amy Goodman with Juan Gonzalez.
You're tuned to listener-supported community radio KBOO, Portland, Oregon, in the beautiful Willamette Valley.
I'm Doug McVeigh, host of Free Culture Radio. Every month, we bring you 30 minutes of news and information about people who use drugs, as we discuss topics like safe supply, safe consumption spaces, decriminalization, legalization, harm reduction, human rights, civil rights, and much more. Tune in and listen to Free Culture Radio on the third Wednesday of each month from 6:30 to 7 p.m. Pacific here on KBOO Community Radio 90.7 FM.
And now, your daily volunteer-produced community newscast, the KBOO Evening News.
Coming up on the KBOO Evening News, the Joint Office of Homeless Services reports successes in the second year of Metro's housing bond. Portland unionized teachers are on the picket line for a fourth day. And the delay to a new farm bill in Congress may mean difficulties for farmers. Good evening. This is the KBOO Evening News for Tuesday, November 7th, 2023. I'm Eric Leuschner. Portland unionized teachers are on the picket line for a second week, with classes being canceled for a fourth day. The Portland Association of Teachers and Portland Public Schools negotiated over the weekend and on Monday, but haven't yet come to an agreement. The key issues include teachers' pay, planning time, mental health support for students, and caps on class sizes. 16 Portland legislators wrote a letter calling on the school district to cut superfluous administrative spending. Most school districts in Oregon spend 3% of their budget on administrative costs. Portland Public Schools spends double that at 6%. State Senator from Portland, Elizabeth Steiner, helped write the budget and said she was frustrated that Portland Public Schools say they don't have the funds to increase teacher pay and cut class sizes after they got a budget bump. Steiner said, quote, "When Superintendent Guerrero testified in front of the legislature that we should fund Portland Public Schools at $10.3 billion, which we did, it feels a little disingenuous to have them come back and say, actually, we can't do that because you didn't give us enough money," end quote. Superintendent Guadalupe Guerrero said in a press conference Monday that the district was already looking at cuts earlier this year, and their current proposal would mean spending down their reserves and cutting $50 million in the next 3 years. A petition seeking to force Douglas County to hand count ballots in future elections has failed again. The Douglas County Republican Party has submitted multiple petitions to the county clerk since last year, and all have been denied. That means the group isn't allowed to officially collect signatures. The party argued that electronic voting machines are not transparent and that they cannot be checked by the public. Oregon state law requires voting machines to be approved by the Secretary of State. They are audited and checked for their accuracy. County Clerk Dan Loomis said the latest petition did not meet the requirements of being a matter of county concern and being legislative. Loomis did not further define what those requirements are and added that he did not want to provide legal advice to the petitioners. The Oregon Secretary of State actually issued a directive last year that essentially bans hand-counting elections in Oregon. Hand-counting still has a place in Oregon elections, primarily as a means to check the results of a machine to verify its accuracy. That method itself involves staff for hours at a time and is itself prone to mistakes. The petitioners could appeal their denial to Douglas County Circuit Court and have a judge decide on the matter. However, they have not appealed any of the previous six denials. Loomis added, quote, "I'm not saying that hand counting is good or bad. I'm just determining this petition that asks us to do hand counting does not pass the constitutional test." Donald Trump testifies in his civil trial. GOP presidential candidates discuss the party's disconnect from reality, and states tackle a host of issues on Election Day. With more on these stories, it's Edwin J. Vieira with 2023 Talks.
Welcome to 2023 Talks, where we're following our democracy in historic times.
The only thing that matters are the facts and the numbers. And numbers, my friends, don't lie.
New York Attorney General Letitia James says the case against former President Donald Trump in his civil trial stands in spite of the outrage he voiced in his testimony. While on the stand, the former president attacked James and court officials as Democrats and biased Trump haters, but James says none of that refutes the evidence. Judge Arthur N. Goron has already ruled against the Trump Organization in a summary judgment. He found the former president and his family routinely defrauded banks and insurers by exaggerating his net worth. Trump is lashing back against the ruling with typical rage.
This is a case that should have never been brought. It's a case that should be dismissed immediately. The fraud was on behalf of the court. The court was the fraudster in this case.
Though those charges don't carry prison time, they could serve as a death sentence for Trump's businesses. Still, he has massive support in the GOP primary, and a New York Times poll even found he's slightly ahead of President Joe Biden in six battleground states. On the campaign trail, former New Jersey Governor Chris Christie says the lies and misinformation spread by the former president have helped disconnect Republicans from reality.
The problem is you fear the truth. The problem is you want to shout down any voice that says anything different than what you want to hear.
Christie's not the only Republican candidate talking in that way. Former Arkansas Governor Asa Hutchinson says Trump will likely be found guilty in his criminal and civil trials.
As a party, we must support the rule of law. We cannot win as a country without integrity in the White House. And while some will ignore the destructive behavior of the former president, I assure you, we ignore it at our own peril.
Normally, low-drama school board elections in Idaho today are drawing more focus than usual because book bans there could impact what students are allowed to read. Kurt Zwolfer, director of The Cabin, a center for readers and writers in Boise, says aggressive school boards are overstepping their duties.
They're actually restricting the other parents' rights on what their kids can consume, both for reading and for media.
The American Library Association says U.S. book challenges hit an all-time high of 1,200 in 2022, almost double the number from the year before. A new poll says more than a third of rural voters could be swayed on kitchen table issues. Pollster Celinda Lake says the high cost of living and affordable housing are top issues in the small towns across numerous states, and there are other economic policies to watch.
The fact that we've come out of this really tough time and CEOs are hoarding the wealth and the prosperity for themselves and not sharing it with the people who actually produce that wealth and prosperity, that they're shipping jobs massively overseas.
I'm Edwin J. Vieira for Pacifica Network and Public News Service. Find our trust indicators at publicnewsservice.org.
Specialized organic farming called biodynamic farming is not that common in the United States. Adherents believe the farm is a living organism and focus on the health of its interrelated systems for their greater productivity and sustainability. Deborah Van Fleet has the details in Nebraska.
Biodynamic farming is a very specialized type of organic farming not practiced widely in the United States, although it has existed worldwide since the 1920s. Of the roughly 150 certified biodynamic farms in the country, only two are in Nebraska. One of them is the Common Good Farm near Raymond in the southeastern part of the state. Co-owner Everett Lundquist is also director of biodynamic certification for Demeter USA. He says one of the core principles of biodynamic farming is viewing the farm as an organism. And like all organisms, it is made up of organs and systems.
On a farm, for example, you would have an immunity system. So you have plants and there's diseases in plants, and what are causing those diseases, and what's the immune system for those plants to actually flourish, not just exist.
Unlike with organic farming, where a single crop can be certified, the whole farm has to be certified biodynamic. Lundquist says bringing health and vitality to the soil is a fundamental motivation of biodynamic farming, and that livestock is a key element in that process. Also key, which Lundquist says some people find mysterious, are the preparations used in biodynamic farming, including field sprays and compost preparations.
How they're made is unusual based on modern kind of materialistic thinking, but there is a scientific background for them, and they have been studied and are shown to work.
Mark Brannan and his family incorporate biodynamic practices on their 1.5-acre farm in Omaha's Benson neighborhood. Brannan says these include thinking of the farm as a whole system and using composting and cover crops for soil health.
But you focus on the biological process, then I think the physical features of soil and the chemical features take care of themselves. So we just worry about creating a healthy environment, you know, for soil microbes, and then everything else kind of takes care of itself.
Beth Corium is co-owner of the other Nebraska-certified biodynamic farm, Meadowlark Hearth in Scotts Bluff. It specializes in biodynamically certified vegetable seeds.
I hope that more people will understand that the earth is a living being. And if they understand that or learn about it, then I think biodynamics will be more prevalent.
For Nebraska News Connection, I'm Deborah Van Fleet. This story was produced with original reporting by Ellie Kuckelman for The Reader.
A new Alabama law aids thousands in regaining their driver's licenses after license suspension for debt-related issues. The recently passed Senate Bill 154 offers a safety net for people missing one court date appearance or two payments before facing suspension. Shantia Hudson has more.
A new law in Alabama is helping thousands regain their driving privileges after license suspension for debt-related reasons. Senate Bill 154 allows individuals to miss one court appearance or two payments before facing suspension. Previously, even a single missed payment or court date could result in a license being revoked. Alabama Appleseed's Leah Nelson conducted a survey on fines and found they put a strain on working families and keep them trapped in a cycle of debt.
People were on the regular giving up things like utility payments, food and medicine and rent, making really desperate sacrifices so that they could make payments toward their legal debt. They were taking out payday loans.
Alabama Appleseed's report titled Under Pressure reveals that approximately 40% of people surveyed resorted to committing crimes such as theft in order to settle their outstanding tickets. The bill received bipartisan support. Nelson says the impacts extend far beyond individuals and households, affecting economic progress. Alabama faces low workforce participation, and many people with suspended licenses struggle to find work. She says without a license, job opportunities are limited, a crucial point to convey to lawmakers.
If you have a labor shortage and you have a whole bunch of people who can't effectively work because of an administrative decision the state has made to penalize poverty, maybe you need to reconsider that decision.
She says while the new law doesn't solve every problem, it does give people more flexibility. Now people who have suspensions because of missed court dates can take steps to get them reinstated.
All you have to do to clear a failure to appear suspension is appear before a judge, and then they will send a clearance letter. You still have to pay a fee to the Alabama Law Enforcement Agency, that's our DMV, to get your license back, but you don't have to make any payments towards your ticket.
She says another major change was made regarding compliance hearings. Now, if you miss one, you won't be suspended. However, you can still face suspensions if you miss two compliance hearings or two payments on a payment plan. For Alabama News Service, I'm Shantia Hudson.
You're listening to the KBOO Evening News. Stay tuned after this newscast for an in-depth report on a local Jewish Voice for Peace activist who was arrested at ceasefire protests at the Capitol Rotunda in Washington, D.C. At 6 o'clock, it's Transpositive PDX. Then at 7, For the Wild. Tonight's weather will be cloudy with a low of 46 degrees. Tomorrow's weather will be sunny with a high of 54. Today in history, in 1940, the Tacoma Narrows Bridge collapses in a windstorm just 4 months after completion. It has retroactively been called Galloping Gertie. The quote of the day is from Nobel Prize-winning chemist and physicist Marie Curie, who was born this day in 1867. She said, quote, "Nothing in life is to be feared, it is only to be understood." American, Canadian, and tribal officials are set to meet on coal mine pollution that crosses the border. With that story and more, it's Antonia Gonzalez with National Native News.
This is National Native News. I'm Antonia Gonzalez. Federal officials from the U.S. and Canada plan to meet with Montana and British Columbia tribes over coal mining pollution. Montana Public Radio's Aaron Bolton has more on the meeting.
The U.S. State Department and Global Affairs Canada will meet with the Confederated Salish and Kootenai tribes and the Tanaha Nation on November 9th. The meeting aims to address selenium pollution coming from Teck Resources coal mining operations along the Elk River. The Elk River flows into Lake Coconusa and the Kootenai River in Montana. Selenium pollution is known to harm fish reproduction. The tribes want the issue to be settled by the International Joint Commission, which handles transboundary water disputes between the U.S. and Canada. CSKT Chairman Tom McDonald hopes IJC involvement would eventually lead to the closure of Teck's mines.
We would want to make sure that they're going to immediately cease and desist from their actions that are causing an increase in pollution.
The meeting comes after President Joe Biden and Prime Minister Justin Trudeau announced that a deal to address selenium pollution would come by summer's end. That deadline was never met. McDonald says it's possible that a deal could be struck at this month's meeting. I'm Aaron Bolton.
Kodiak's Aleutic Museum in Alaska recently acquired a newly minted atkuk, a kind of traditional clothing. KMXT's Brian Venois has more.
An atkuk is a type of traditional Aleutic clothing. This one kind of looks like a black floor-length dress with red stripes and white fur. Amanda Lancaster is a curator of collections at the Aleutic Museum.
Snowfalling parka is what these are sometimes known as, and when someone is dancing wearing it, you see, you know, the ermentals just sort of sway, and it really does look like, you know, snow falling.
The atkuk was commissioned by the museum about a year ago, and staff received the new piece just a few weeks ago. She says once they had the funding, they talked to a local artist to help them fill the gap in their collections.
We have never had a traditional atkuk like this.
The commission was funded through a grant from the Rasmussen Foundation, which awards grants to Alaska-based nonprofits and tribes. Lancaster says commissioning pieces helps the museum have one of the most complete collections on Aleutic culture in the world.
It's a really good chance to see, like, what are the holes in our collection that maybe there are Aleutic cultural materials in other museums that we do not have that we would, you know, like to get.
Lancaster says adding to their collections will be a major help in continuing revival movements after historic suppression. The Aleutic Museum is currently undergoing major renovations, though, so the public will have to wait to see the atkuk in person until they reopen in 2025. I'm Brian Venois.
The chief of the Confederated Tribes of Coos, Lower Umpqua, and Siyislaw Indians died this weekend. KLCC's Brian Bull has this remembrance of Doc Slider.
Chief Donald Doc Slider was fond of carving and playing Native American flutes. He's heard playing one of his creations in a 2018 recording for KLCC. Brenda Brainerd is a fellow tribal member who worked with Slider on restoring federal recognition for their people in the 1980s. She says he battled cancer in his final years.
What will always stand out to me with Doc was his smile. He just had the cutest, sweetest little smile, and it kind of had a hint of impishness with it. But what I remember most about him was his quietness. He was very calm. He was a very humble man.
Slider was also a U.S. Army veteran. In a statement, U.S. Representative Val Hoyle said Slider's spirit and his memory leave a legacy of resilience and hope.
I'm Brian Bull.
And I'm Antonia Gonzalez.
With a new U.S. House Speaker in place, those watching the next farm bill hope productive discussions can resume. But it appears unlikely Congress can pass legislation by year's end. The last time this massive legislation wasn't approved on schedule was 2012, forcing lawmakers to extend provisions of the 2008 version. Roz Brown has more in New Mexico.
The once every 5-year farm bill will likely be extended to 6 years this time around, as Congress seems months away from finding a path forward, if not longer. The legislation governs an array of agricultural and food programs, including the Supplemental Nutrition Assistance Program, better known as SNAP, which Democrats typically want to expand and Republicans want to trim. Aaron Shire with the National Farmers Union says SNAP is the nation's most significant anti-hunger program, and the union is eager for Congress to pass a bill that protects and strengthens the program.
It's very much about those nutrition programs, making sure those nutrition programs remain strong. The Farm Bill's been described as a Swiss Army knife. There are many different tools to address many different challenges.
Nearly 23% of New Mexico's population is enrolled in SNAP, the highest of any state. The current Farm Bill lapsed in October, but most lawmakers consider January 1st as the last possible date for approving a new one. Congress also missed the scheduled Farm Bill approval date in 2012, leading to an extension of the 2008 version. The Farm Bill also encompasses commodities, or basic goods and materials, as well as farm credit, rural development, and conservation. To that end, two decades ago, Congress embraced the Conservation Stewardship Program to pay farmers for making soil and water conservation part of their daily operations. In recent farm bills, that funding has been cut significantly. Nonetheless, Shire says his members consider conservation essential to agriculture because at its core, farming is about stewardship.
It's of our environment, of our climate, and those farmers are great stewards. They want to be better. And they need those conservation programs to make sure those conservation measures are affordable.
Environmental advocates want the bill to include more money for climate-smart farming to tackle wide-scale changes caused by global warming, while the GOP is focused on increasing subsidies for three specific southern crops, peanuts, cotton, and rice. This is Roz Brown, New Mexico News Connection.
Biden is having a hard time selling his two-part strategy of 100% support of Israel and protecting Gaza's civilian population. His support of a humanitarian pause isn't likely to win over critics. One analyst says Biden needs to call for a ceasefire and support a Palestinian state. Now we go to Global Citizen commentary on the issue from Portland State Professor Emeritus Mel Gertov. The opinions expressed in the following piece are those of the speaker.
Hello, everyone. Presidents always face uncomfortable choices, supporting human rights versus providing weapons to governments that consistently violate human rights, adding to the nuclear weapons stockpile versus spending money on more usable weapons, sanctioning an adversary or working with it. In the Middle East today, Joe Biden's choice is between wholeheartedly supporting Israel and doing all he can to protect the innocents in Gaza. He's trying to do both, but is not satisfying advocates of either policy. In Israel, Biden's pressure on the Netanyahu government to avoid a full-out invasion of Gaza, provide humanitarian aid, and avoid unnecessary civilian casualties are resented by the Israeli far right. It wants 100% support, period. And it has a powerful argument. It has been attacked. Many innocent lives have been lost, and there are well over 200 hostages. Nor is Biden's approach appreciated in Palestinian circles, in Arab countries, in the UN leadership, or by human rights groups in the U.S., progressives in Congress, and some officials in his own State Department. They all see his policy as impossibly contradictory. You can't have an ironclad pro-Israel policy and expect to moderate Israel's actions in Gaza. Biden is caught in a bind not entirely of his making. To be sure, his continuation of a long tradition of unconditional U.S. military aid to Israel, which is using U.S. weapons in the Gaza war, undermines the credibility of his attempt to slow down Israel's advances in Gaza. But more broadly, war policy is under the control of a right-wing government in Tel Aviv that not only wants to decapitate Hamas, but also use the war to exert new controls on the Palestinian population. Unless Biden is willing to do what no previous U.S. administration has been willing to do, namely impose severe restrictions on U.S. economic and military aid and political support, subject to Israel's behavior in Gaza, the administration has no leverage. That unwillingness to use U.S. leverage also undercuts Biden's entire Middle East policy. He can't expect Saudi Arabia to move on normalizing relations with Israel. He can't expect support from the region or from developing countries for putting pressure on Iran and Hezbollah not to enter the fighting. Nor at home can Biden expect understanding from Palestinian and other Muslim communities, or even from progressive Jews, on his current policy. All these groups see the glaring contradiction, not the logic, of fully supporting Israel, but while calling for its restraint. They all are calling on the administration to push for a ceasefire. But Biden, like previous presidents, seems to have given Israel veto power over such calls. Netanyahu has explicitly ruled out a ceasefire until the hostages have been released. Biden has finally called for a pause to get the prisoners out, he says, but not for a ceasefire. Yet only a ceasefire holds out any hope for the release of some hostages, for saving civilian lives in Gaza, for enabling hospitals to treat the wounded, and for opening the way to more substantial humanitarian aid. The fundamental dilemma that Biden faces is that he's the inheritor of many decades of unqualified U.S. support of Israel. Numerous critics over those years have warned of the consequences of that support, most especially for the deprivation of Palestinian rights and the denial of their statehood aspirations. Liberals in the U.S. government, notably in Congress, have from time to time tried to tie U.S. aid to Israel's apartheid policies, as Jimmy Carter called them, but politics at home, the Israel lobby in short, has always nipped that effort in the bud. I sympathize with Biden's situation. I believe he and other top U.S. officials are truly concerned about, perhaps even appalled by, the devastation of Gaza and the civilian deaths there. Secretary of State Antony Blinken made an impassioned plea for protection of Palestinian civilians in a Washington Post op-ed, saying, quote, that preventing a humanitarian catastrophe in Gaza is vital to Israel's security. And we know that Biden is no friend of Netanyahu. He probably mistrusts any assurances Netanyahu has given him about trying to limit civilian losses of life and property. Yet, as the New York Times recently described, Biden has a long and deeply personal history of support for Israel, so much so that, quote, a longtime Israeli official more recently called him the first Jewish president. He has made numerous trips to Israel and has met with every Israeli prime minister since Golda Meir. No doubt Biden can count on considerable financial support for his presidential campaign from Jewish organizations. All these ties only tighten the bind he's in because they increase his difficulty in dealing with members of Congress and State Department officials who are now sharply critical of his policy. They don't see the choices he's making as either wise or humane. What they and we do see every day is video and photographs of deadly bombardments that are making Gaza a moonscape and killing scores of innocent people with every strike. I'm Mel Gertow for the Global Citizen. Thanks for listening.
You're listening to the KBOO Evening News for Tuesday, November 7, 2023. This is a volunteer-produced newscast, and we encourage your participation. Call or text us with your breaking news stories and tips at 971-245-2158. Our remote production team for tonight's newscast includes Mel Gertov, Reed Johnson, and Josh Salem. The producer is Althea Billings, and our engineer is Otto. Special thanks to Antonia Gonzalez, Edwin J. Vieira, Roz Brown, Shantia Hudson, Deborah Van Fleet, and Tramel Gomes. The director of the evening news is Althea Billings. A podcast of this newscast is available on our website at kboo.fm/eveningnews. You are listening to KBOO Portland on 90.7 FM, K282BH Philomath on 104.3 FM, and K220HR Hood River on 91.9 FM. I'm Eric Leuschner. All of our KBOO programs, including the evening news, are supported by our members. If you would like to become a member and support our programming, you can go to kboo.fm/give or text KBOO to the number 44321. Stay tuned now for KBOO News in Depth.
At KBOO, we accept many kinds of vehicle donations. We accept fuzzy vans, broken cars, zippy scooters, seaworthy boats, well-worn farm equipment, family-sized SUVs, old jet skis, and more. If your vehicle has a clean title, we can take it as a donation. If your vehicle isn't working, we can work with that too. Call 877-KBOO-123. That's 877-526-6123. Or go to our website, kboo.fm/vehicle.
This is Cesar Chavez. You're listening to KBOO, listener-sponsored radio.
Sound was used for centuries as a method of torture. Place someone's head inside of a bell and ring it.
Tune in to KBOO every other Tuesday at 3 a.m. for the Vinyl Pajama Party with your erstwhile host, Brian.
And eventually, they'll go insane.
You never know what you will find on your radio / interwebs during the show, but it will be something.
They're going insane. And eventually...
That's the Vinyl Pajama Party, alternating Tuesdays at 3 a.m., only on your community radio station, KBOO Portland.
KBOO News In Depth, where we take a deeper look at the top news stories impacting our community.
My name is Alana Goldman. I graduated from Portland State University in 2020. I used to live in Portland for about 6 years. I live in LA now, but I did a lot of anti-Zionist organizing in Portland when I lived there.
And Alana, do you mind just for our listeners also describing for yourself what anti-Zionism, what anti-Zionist activism means to you? I think that might be a term that you know, people misunderstand or might not be accurately represented in media.
Yeah, you're right that it is very inaccurately represented in media. Actually, at PSU, I took a class called History of Zionism because I wanted, when I was unlearning all of my own propaganda as a Jewish person, I wanted to get my receipts. I wanted to like make it clear that I was learning the history of how Zionism was started as an anti-Zionist. And so I took this course basically learning about like the foundations of Zionism and like Theodor Herzl, who was one of the founders of Zionism, which basically means like the idea that Jews should have their own state as a form of protection. However, there's a lot to unpack there. Jews have been in the diaspora for thousands of years, which has kept us safe. And also when you create one ethno state for one people, when someone else is already there,